This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to our evening session on virtual colonoscopy. I'm thrilled to be able to spend part of the evening with you talking about one of my favorite subjects. This is entitled Virtual Colonoscopy, A Kinder, Gentler Way to Prevent Colon Cancer. And the key here, and you can see that I've bolded the word prevent, because it's not only a test to detect colon cancer, but the goal really is to prevent colon cancer. I'm going to emphasize this again throughout the lecture, because I always say that, you know, colorectal cancer is a malignancy that is very different from other cancers, in that we know the precursor lesion. And if we were to get every one of you in here to get screened for colorectal cancer and to detect this, what we call the precursor adenomatous polyp, we could essentially prevent the cancer from ever occurring, right? And our challenge is really to get everybody in here to get screened. So my name is Dr. Judy Yee, and I am a professor and vice chair of radiology at UCSF. I also am the chief of radiology at the San Francisco VA Medical Center. I hold other national titles. I'm president of the Society of Abdominal Radiology. I chair the Colon Cancer Committee for the American College of Radiology as well. And so, you know, I start off with this, which is, why should you even care? Why are you here? And why is this so important? Is that even if you have no symptoms of colorectal cancer, and some of the symptoms might be something as nonspecific as just abdominal pain, and everybody has abdominal pain, right, at some point, but change in your bowel habits, bleeding, you know, in the stool, those are all symptoms, potentially, of colorectal cancer. But even if you don't have any of that, the American Cancer Society recommends that all men and women starting at the age of 50, if you're asymptomatic, should come in for some sort of colon cancer screening test. All right. Why else should you care? Well, someone you know currently has colorectal cancer. They may not know it. You may not know it, but they have it. Someone you know will develop colorectal cancer. Someone you know will die from colorectal cancer. And as I mentioned earlier, colorectal cancer is entirely preventable in most individuals. So just some epidemiology about colorectal cancer. It is the third most common malignancy in men and women. So in men, it's behind lung and prostate, and in women, it's behind lung and breast. However, when you think about men and women together, colorectal cancer is actually the second leading cause of cancer deaths. It represents about 10% of all new cancer cases per year, and there are approximately 140,000 new cases and about 50,000 deaths due to colorectal cancer each year. And this is just to bring home the point again in terms of estimated new cases. You can see that cancers of the colorectum are the third leading cause in men and women, and the estimated deaths when you combine men and women together is the second most common cause. Now, the overall lifetime risk for development is about 5%, and that is about 1 in 19 individuals will develop colorectal cancer. The overall lifetime risk for dying from colorectal cancer is close to 3%. There's a slightly higher rate of colorectal cancer in men compared to women. And this last line is particularly important, that even though we know that there are certain risk factors that will increase your chances of developing colorectal cancer, by far, most cases are considered sporadic, occurring in average risk individuals. So no family history even. And that's 75% of cases. Now, when you look at the estimated deaths that occurred in 2014, you can see, as I mentioned, slightly higher rates in men compared to women. And I just wanted to emphasize that in women, you know, women come in for their mammograms, for breast cancer screening, for their pap smears, for cervical cancer screening. But the number of deaths due to colorectal cancer in women, this about equals the number of deaths from cervical, ovarian, and endometrial cancers combined. And yet women still hesitate to come in to get screened for colorectal cancer. Now, what are some risk factors for the development of colorectal cancer? Some would say just age, and in that most colorectal cancers occur in older individuals after the age of 50. There are known familial factors, so familial adenomatous polyposis syndrome, Gardner syndrome. In a cohort of the patient population, the Ashkenazi Jewish population. And all three of these, FAP, Gardner's, and the Ashkenazi Jewish population, is all thought to be related to this adenomatous polyposis coli gene, which is located on chromosome number 5. And then you have your hereditary non-polyposis colorectal cancers. African Americans also have increased incidence, and that's why the recommendation is that African Americans start screening earlier at age 45. If you have a personal or a close family history, and by a close family history, I mean a first-degree relative who has colorectal cancer or adenomatous polyps, this also puts you at increased risk. In women, if you have a history of ovarian, endometrial, or breast cancer, this puts you at increased risk. And then finally, in patients with inflammatory bowel disease of long duration, and by that I mean lasting greater than 10 years, more commonly in ulcerative colitis compared to Crohn's disease, this will put you at increased risk. However, this pie chart brings home the point again that the majority of cases of colorectal cancer occur sporadically in patients who have no known risk factors, so considered average risk patients. Now, there are certain environmental risk factors that have been found to be associated with an increased risk for developing colorectal cancer. And when you look at this list, it's basically everything that's bad for you, right? So it's having a low-fiber, high-fat diet, eating lots of red meat, being sedentary or overweight, and then smoking and alcohol. Now, at the same time, there are certain medications and vitamins that may help prevent colorectal cancer, and perhaps the best studied are aspirin and the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. In women, postmenopausal estrogen therapy, and then you can see all of the minerals and the vitamins, so certainly worthwhile to take your daily multivitamin. Now, it's interesting to note there are different segments of the colon, and when we talk about virtual colonoscopy and colonoscopy, we think about six segments of the colon. And the bottom of the colon is called the rectum, and that continues on into the sigmoid, and then the descending colon, and then the transverse colon, the ascending colon, and the cecum. And so those are the six segments. And it's interesting to note that in the 1940s, you can see that by far the majority of colorectal cancers occurred in the rectosigmoid, up to 80%, whereas there were relatively fewer number of cases in the right colon. Why is this important is that the right colon is particularly difficult to get to. In fact, if you have a flexible sigmoidoscopy, which is one of the options, one of the colorectal cancer screening tools, that doesn't even reach the right colon. You have cases of colonoscopy where it's very difficult to get to the right colon. So it's a challenging area for certain patients to evaluate. And it's interesting to note that since 1970, there's been a relative decrease in the number of colorectal cancers that occur in the rectosigmoid, so in the bottom of the colon that's relatively easier to examine, compared to the right colon, which is the ascending colon and the cecum. So more cases are occurring out of reach of that sigmoidoscope in a tougher area to examine. However, the right colon is a relatively easier area to examine using the virtual colonoscopy. Okay. And this is just a graphic to show you the different segments again. As I mentioned, the very bottom of the colon is called the rectum. This very tortuous segment right here is going to be your sigmoid. And by far, you can see the majority of colorectal cancers, about 55%, will occur in the rectosigmoid. This then leads up the descending colon. Okay, that's your third segment. Fourth segment is your transverse colon. Coming down the ascending colon, this is your fifth segment, and then the cecum is your sixth segment. Okay, and here's your little appendix. Now, as I mentioned, since the 1970s, there's been a relative increase in the number of cases of right-sided colorectal cancers. Now, it seems a little not intuitive in that your right, sitting in the audience, is right here, right? However, this is the body facing you. So when we talk about right on a CT scan, for example, or on this image, the right colon is actually this part of the colon, okay? And again, most cancers in this area, we have seen increasing cancers, though, in the right colon. Now, why has there been this relative increase in these right-sided cancers is that we have performed more colonoscopies, and the colonoscopies are this, you know, 6-foot-long scope that's extended through the colon to get to the right side of the colon. So they've detected more of these proximal or right-sided lesions. There's increase in the number of polyps that have been detected because more colonoscopies, more sigmoidoscopies have been performed of the sigmoid or the distal bottom portion of the colon. And when they discover those polyps, they will resect them and prevent the cancers from occurring in the bottom of the colon. It's interesting to note that there's actually a racial difference in terms of the frequency of right-sided cancers, more common in African Americans, and then whites, and then Asians. And it's also interesting to note that women tend to have more right-sided cancers. Now, as I mentioned, there is this precursor lesion that can develop into colorectal cancer. And most colorectal cancers will develop from this adenomatous polyp. And the risk of developing cancer or harboring cancer is related to size. So size of the polyp is used as a surrogate measure for the likelihood of harboring malignancy. And you can see here that the size between 1 to 5 millimeters is a lesion that we really do not have to be concerned about, in that there's a 0% chance of it being malignant. Okay, so the really, we call these diminutive polyps, are really not of concern. And the American College of Radiology recommends that we don't even need to report these. Okay, the small size polyps, the 6 to 9 millimeter polyps, are still relatively low frequency of harboring malignancy. You can see less than 1%. Okay. And then as we increase in size to 10 to 20 millimeters, there's up to 10%. And you can see as it continues to increase in size, the risk of harboring malignancy just continues to rise to over 25%. Now, the good news is that for a 10 millimeter or smaller polyp, it takes a very long time for it to transition into an invasive carcinoma, about 10 years. So this is a very large window of opportunity for us to detect the polyp, to refer you to colonoscopy, and then to have it taken out, and then you prevent the colorectal cancer. Now, what's the prevalence of these adenomatous polyps? Probably higher than you think, in that 25%, so 1 in 4 of you by the age of 50 will have an adenomatous polyp. And this continues to increase with increasing age. So that by age 80, you can see that over 50%, up to 60%, will actually have one of these adenomatous polyps. The risk of malignancy is also related to the histology of the particular polyp. So the most common type of adenomatous polyp is what we call a tubular adenoma. The bad type is when you add in what we call villous elements, right? So you can have a tubulovillous adenoma, so there's mixed tubular and villous histology, or a complete villous adenoma, right? And once you throw in that villous element into it, you can see that it increases your malignant potential 10 times that of just a plain old tubular adenoma. Now, because we know that we can prevent colorectal cancers by screening, the joint guidelines from the American Cancer Society, in coordination with the American College of Radiology and the U.S. Multi-Society Task Force. And the U.S. Multi-Society Task Force is composed of the gastroenterology associations, came out with a really excellent set of guidelines back in 2008 that we still continue to follow. And in this really sort of landmark joint guidelines, they separated out the various colorectal cancer tests that can be used for evaluation of the colon. And the first group of tests that they separated out were the ones that could detect both the adenomatous polyp as well as the cancer. And these are the tests that they recommend, either the flexible sigmoidoscopy every 5 years. And remember, flexible sigmoidoscopy is a shorter type of colonoscopy so that the scope only examines that bottommost portion of the colon, the rectum and the sigmoid, all right? So it never makes it into the right colon. The double contrast barium enema every 5 years, and this is another radiology test outside of the CT colonography, which uses a dense product called barium that's instilled into the colon, coats the colon. We still have to distend the colon with a gas, and then we evaluate for polyps and cancer. CT colonography every 5 years. At this point, we've gotten it down to very low radiation dose, lower dose than the double contrast barium enema, and I'll talk more about that a little bit later. And then colonoscopy, and you'll hear this called either optical colonoscopy, fiber optic colonoscopy, traditional colonoscopy. There's really nothing traditional about it, but that's the colonoscopy every 10 years. The second group of tests are the ones that primarily detect cancer. So these tests are really not meant to identify the precursor lesion, right? And in fact, in this joint guideline, they say that colon cancer prevention is really the primary goal of screening. And so naturally, the preference would be for this group of tests because you can detect the precursor lesion as well as the cancer itself. But in this group of the tests that primarily detect cancer, we have the fecal occult blood test or the fecal immunochemical test. And these are the cards where you have to take the consecutive stool samples, and you place them on the card, the stool samples on the card, and you send that back in. Okay. The stool DNA test was recently approved for reimbursement by Medicare. But according to these guidelines, the interval is still unknown because it's not been updated yet. The recommendation, according to Medicare, is a stool DNA test every 3 years. Okay, and the reimbursement is at about $500. And this is where actually you get a kit and you have to actually obtain an entire stool sample. Okay, so it has a bucket, and you have to send in the whole stool sample. It's not just a small smear. It's the whole stool sample, okay? So the compliance, I think, is not so clear with that. So just, you know, image-wise, to show you what the currently available and recommended colorectal cancer screening tests are according to the joint guidelines of the American Cancer Society, American College of Radiology, and the U.S. Multi-Society Task Force, this is the flexible sigmoidoscope, okay? So it looks like the colonoscopy, except that it's shorter, right? This is the barium enema exam. This is an image from the CT colonography using a CT scanner. And we'll go through a little bit more about how this is done. And then this is the colonoscopy, all right? These are the tests that detect cancer, and it's the fecal occult blood test. Some of you may be familiar with this. And then this is the stool DNA test, and here's that bucket I was talking about. Okay, so we have all these options, and, you know, CTC was first placed as an option back in 2008 by the American Cancer Society. We can see that we are an aging population with baby boomers now, many over the age of 50, and the census is done every 10 years. Back in 2010, they found that there were 96 million adults over the age of 50 in the United States. How are we doing in terms of colorectal cancer screening? Well, if you look at the numbers here, you can see that the fecal occult blood test, about 9% of patients have had that. When you look at endoscopy, and this includes either the sigmoidoscopy or colonoscopy, you can see about 56% have had that. And when you combine for either, it's close to 60% of individuals have undergone some sort of colorectal cancer screening. I think the key is to focus really on the 50 to 60-year-old group, and this is lower. So patients who are age 65 and above tend to get screened at about a 10% higher rate than the 50 to 60-year-old, okay? And the point being that there is still a significant large percentage of the population who never comes in for colorectal cancer screening, and this is where we're not preventing enough colon cancers in this country. Congress has recognized this and has proclaimed that March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. And in 2014, you can see this was a proclamation that was sent out there. The National Colorectal Cancer Roundtable has set this goal, which is that 80% of Americans should be screened for colorectal cancer by 2018. And we really feel that if CT colonography or virtual colonoscopy is added as a valid tool, that this will help us to achieve this goal. Okay, so what are some of the advantages of virtual colonoscopy? And I have CT colonography, which is really interchangeable in terms of the terminology for virtual colonoscopy. But what are some of its advantages are that, well, it is less invasive. And this should translate into better patient acceptance. And there are many studies that have shown that offering CT colonography or virtual colonoscopy does bring a lot more patients in for screening. It is safer than colonoscopy. Why? What are the risks of colonoscopy? Well, you're, you know, using a 6-foot-long scope that has to make its way through the entire colon. You can poke a hole in the colon and cause a perforation, right? You can cause significant bleeding of the colon from just mechanical trauma, and then infection if the scopes aren't cleaned well enough. So these are uncommon, but they do occur. The risk of perforation from CTC is very low and is about 10 to 20 times lower compared to colonoscopy. Virtual colonoscopy was first introduced back in 1994. There's never been a death due to this test, and yet there are deaths every year due to the colonoscopy test itself. Okay, so I'm going to repeat that. There's never been a death due to virtual colonoscopy since it was introduced back in 1994, and yet patients who come in for healthy patients coming in for colorectal cancer screening undergoing a colonoscopy, there is that real risk because there are deaths that are reported every year due to colonoscopy. It's a very short procedural time, so using state-of-the-art multi-detector CT scanners, we can scan in less than 10 seconds in each position. So we scan twice with the patient lying on their back and the patient lying on their belly, and it's a very quick examination. There's no need for sedation. Compared to colonoscopy, you don't have to take off the whole day from work. You can have the test first thing in the morning and return to your normal daily activities. When you have a colonoscopy, you require sedation, and they will not let you drive home. So you have to have somebody else take off time, attend the test with you, and drive you home. It is less costly compared to the colonoscopy. It affords you the ability to evaluate structures outside of the colon. So if you think about it, coming in with just abdominal pain, is it attributable to the colon? It may not be, and yet CTC can look and find perhaps it's a kidney stone or something else is going on that may be causing your abdominal pain. And then finally, I think that gastroenterologists will even say this, is that there are just not enough of the gastroenterologists to perform all the screening colonoscopies that are needed in our aging population. So just going through what's still necessary in preparing you for this particular CT scan, the virtual colonoscopy. As the patient, you still have to undergo dietary restriction. And so the recommendation is that you stay on a clear liquid diet on the day before the CT scan. This may be particularly difficult for elderly and frail patients or diabetic patients. And so we do allow in the early morning on the day before the CT scan that there can be a small amount of solids, and this includes, you know, a couple of crackers or a slice of white bread. Patients should stay hydrated throughout the day on the day before, and then laxatives are still given. You're still required to undergo bowel cleansing in the late afternoon on the day before the CT scan. And then finally, at what is recommended from the American College of Radiology and what we are doing is administering what we call a tagging agent. So in addition to staying hydrated and taking the laxative, there are products that we will ask you to drink that will help tag the residual material in the colon, allowing us to better differentiate residual material in the colon from a true soft tissue polyp. Okay. Now, the allowed food products on the day before the CT or the virtual colonoscopy is water, you can see. We said a clear liquid diet, so clear juices, broth, gelatin, soft drinks are okay, coffee and tea. And you can see popsicles. And then, as I mentioned, for the very frail patients who really have a hard time tolerating just a completely clear liquid diet on the day before, we say a little bit of solid in the morning on the day before is okay. These are the foods that you need to avoid on the day before the virtual colonoscopy. So anything with fiber, anything with fat, and milk products. Okay, all the good stuff you have to stay off of, right? Okay. And then, as I mentioned, the laxative or the cathartic is still necessary. So the colon must be clean for us to identify these precursor polyps. And there are various options. We have what we call the drier prep, and we call it dry because it leaves the colon relatively dry. And this consists of either magnesium citrate or the sodium phosphate. Here at UCSF, we prefer the use of magnesium citrate. You can see that the sodium phosphate is contraindicated in patients with kidney problems, renal insufficiency, or with congestive heart failure. There is the wet prep, which leaves the colon relatively wet, and this is not preferred for the virtual colonoscopy, because when you have a lot of residual fluid in the colon, this can obscure lesions and the polyps. And this consists of the 4 liters. I don't know how many of you have undergone colonoscopy, but it's that big jug that's 4 liters of a mildly salty solution that is ingested within 2 to 3 hours on the day before the CTC or the virtual colonoscopy. We do not prefer that for virtual colonoscopy, as I mentioned, because you can imagine with that 4-liter jug, you really do have a lot of fluid left in the colon. And as I mentioned, you know, on colonoscopy, it's not as much of an issue because they can just, when they introduce the scope, they can aspirate out or suck out the residual fluid, whereas for CTC, it may cause a problem if there's too much residual fluid. There's some studies, and we published a study out of here, looking at the reduced volume, half volume, so 2 liters of the polyethylene glycol, which seems to work quite well, particularly compared to the mag citrate. So that's an alternative as well. And then we have the bisacodyl or the Dulcolax tablets and suppository, which is not given by itself, but given in conjunction with one of these preps. This looks very complicated, but it's really not. And as I mentioned, clear liquid diet on the day before the CTC or the virtual colonoscopy. This is a tagging protocol from a large a multi-site trial that was published in New England Journal of Medicine, and the San Francisco VA was one of the 15 sites included in that trial. So we've been actually using this tagging and cleansing protocol for many years with success. So there are several products that are administered. This Tagatol V is a barium product, a higher density, 40% weight to volume, given in three doses. And you can see it 8 a.m., 11 a.m., and then 2 p.m., with the larger dose of 20 ml given in, at the earlier time. And then the 10 ml is given at the 11 and at the 2. And again, you have to keep hydrated and continue to drink water. The whole purpose of using this barium product, which is inert, is that once you ingest it, it will mix with the residual material in your small bowel and then in your colon, and it will actually tag the solid stool that's left in the colon when we see it on the CT scan. And so that will allow us to help distinguish the stool from a true polyp. In the late afternoon, about 5 p.m., you will take your laxative or the cathartic, and that can be either the magnesium citrate or the polyethylene glycol. And again, we prefer a saline cathartic. And then in the early evening, 7 p.m., the bisacodyl tablets. Later in the evening, starting at 9 p.m., there's another tagging agent that we will give. And so after you've tagged your solid stool, you give the cathartic or the laxative and you evacuate most of it. What's left behind, that solid, should be tagged. But then you may have fluid that's left behind in the colon. And so this gastrographin is an iodine-based contrast agent, and that's ingested in, again, three doses of 20 ml each starting at 9 p.m., and that is used to tag the residual fluid. So there really is a reasoning behind the order of what's given and the amount that's given. And as I mentioned, we've been using this for many, many years, and it works quite well. So this is a CT scanner, and this is the gantry table, and here is the gantry, this donut-shaped machine. And you will lie on your back for the first scan with your arms raised over your head. This is a carbon dioxide insufflator. So there's a tubing set that comes out here. You can see that attaches to this. And this goes, there's a tip that goes into the bottom of the colon, into the rectum. Carbon dioxide is used to insufflate or distend the colon to allow us to see inside the colon. Okay, so you've cleansed your colon, you've tagged the residual material, you come into the radiology department, and then you the technologist will likely have you evacuate one last time and then place you on the CT scanner table. You'll have the tip inserted gently into the bottom of the colon, and then this electronic device will automatically instill carbon dioxide into the colon. There are detectors in this gantry and an X-ray tube that will generate the images for us. After the first scan, you'll be turned onto your belly. This is called the prone position. Again, the arms are over the head, and we will prop off the trunk from the scanner table with some pillows, and you can see this is a wedge here, and this just allows the gas to travel through the colon much easier and allows for better distension of the colon. And again, scan time in each of the positions you can see is so fast. You can literally breathe in and breathe out and you're done. So it's about 10 seconds, okay? So very, very fast. Now, you might have heard in the media about radiation dose from CT scans, and I can tell you that it really is not a real concern for CTC, in that using the latest techniques, we have gotten the dose extremely low, that is equivalent to or even less than the annual background dose. So let's look at radiation dose from a larger perspective, and let's see what you're getting just walking on this earth each year. Each one of you are getting already what we call this dose, the 3 millisieverts, okay? If you live in higher altitudes like Denver, you actually get 4 times the annual background dose is 12 millisieverts, okay? What about the virtual colonoscopy range? So you can see in the older days, the range was higher at 5 to 8 millisieverts. With the current techniques, and we've been using iterative reconstruction for many years as well, we've gotten it down, as I mentioned, to less than or equal to the 3 millisieverts, which is less than or equal to the annual average background dose. So it's really very low. And again, we're not suggesting that you have the CTC every year. It's recommended every 5 years. Just to give you, again, more of a larger perspective on this, this is from the Health Physics Society, and they state that below 50 to 100 millisieverts, the risks of health effects are either too small to be observed or are non-existent. So what did I say was the dose that you're getting with virtual colonoscopy is less than or equal to 3 millisieverts, right? And here they're saying below 50 to 100. This is a paper that I worked on as well, looking at the risk of radiation-related cancers from virtual colonoscopy and looking at a risk-benefit analysis. And you can see that when you look at the benefit, that's this side, the estimated cancers that were prevented from virtual colonoscopy screening every 5 years was up to about 5,000 cases per 100,000 patients, compared to the estimated induced by radiation cancers from having the virtual colonoscopy screening every 5 years. You can see that's 150 per 100,000 patients. So the benefit to risk ratio, you can see, was very high, which means it just supports that the risk is very low, right, because the benefit is so high. This is what we see when we bring you in to the CT scanner suite and we place you on that CT scanner table that I showed you, and you're insufflated with that carbon dioxide insufflator. This is your colon. And you can see that how beautiful the distension is all the way from the rectum, and this is the sigmoid, which is very tortuous, ascending, the descending colon, transverse colon, ascending colon, here's the cecum, okay? So we can see the 6 segments very well. And this is just a quick overview that is performed. From data that is acquired from the CT scanner, we have these axial images, and this is cutting the body transversely. And the black areas are the distended, gas-filled distended areas of the colon. You can see in this portion of the sigmoid, not very well distended, but that's why we scan in 2 positions. And in the opposing position, the opposite position, you can see better distension in that area, and we've uncovered the soft tissue polyp, okay, a large soft tissue polyp because it measures over 10 millimeters. As well, from the CT scanner data, we can recreate and construct these really exquisite images of the bowel. So the colon here is in green, shaded in green. You can see all these other loops are loops of small bowel. The blue up here is the stomach. With just the click of on the keyboard, you can exclude all of the other bowel except for the colon, because we just want to study the colon, and this is what you get. It's very quick. I showed this before as the teaser, but again, these are the kinds of images we're getting from CT scan, and it very much, there's a polyp, very much simulates what the gastroenterologist would see on the colonoscopy, right?
How big is that?
I didn't measure exactly, but I would estimate that this is a small size polyp, so between 6 to 9 millimeters. This was a cancer And again, you know, we can take the same data and put it into a cube and rotate it 360 degrees for analysis without any additional radiation dose. Just to show you what polyps look like, and there are different morphologies or shapes of polyps. And in fact, the shape helps to guide us as to whether we think that a lesion is a true polyp or not. So this is what's called a sessile polyp. There are two of them. The characteristics are that they are homogeneous, round or ovoid in shape, and that they are in a fixed location when you turn the patient from supine to prone. So from lying on their back to lying on their belly, you can see that these two polyps are in exactly the same location. They're stuck on the wall, okay? And this is the correlative 3D image. You can see here's that fold. So this is a fold, polyp, polyp. Here's that fold on 3D, polyp, polyp. You can have irregularly shaped or lobulated polyps, and this is a nice demonstration of that. I think on this 2D axial image, here is that lesion with a couple of bumps correlated very nicely on this 3D view. And then you can have what we call polyps on a stalk or pedunculated polyps. And very nicely demonstrated is the stalk here, and here's what we call the head of the polyp, okay? So this is a pedunculated polyp. You can see that this is the contrast material that the patient ingested. Remember the tagging agent I was talking about? This white that you see on the CT scan is that tagging agent. And some studies have found that when you see a coating of this contrast agent on the polyp, that it actually indicates a higher chance of having that villous histology, which is the bad histology, right? So the good thing is that, you know, it highlights the polyp for us and draws our eye to detecting these lesions, okay? Just to show you that there are really, excellent views that can be used to correlate and to increase confidence of polyp identification. Here is what we call a dissection view or a fillet view. If you imagine the colon as a tubular structure, what the software can do is to take that tube, cut it along its long axis, and then open it up, flatten it for display. And you can automatically move through all the different segments and makes it very easy. This happens to be a pedunculated polyp shown very nicely on this dissection or fillet view, where here is the stalk. And you can see that the stalk is very long in this particular polyp. And here's the head of the pedunculated polyp. Harder to identify as a pedunculated polyp on the 2D view. And here it is on the traditional fly-through. Again, very hard to see the entire lesion on any one image there. And this is just to show you how nicely we can correlate with what is actually seen on the colonoscopy. And so here is a 2D view of a pedunculated polyp. So here's the stalk, and here's the head of the polyp. On the 3D view, you can see the stalk, and here's the head of the polyp. And here it is correlated very nicely on the colonoscopy view. Sometimes when the polyp falls back on its stalk, it's less obvious on any of these views. And I did want to bring to your attention that there are a lot of studies published validating the accuracy of CT colonography using colonoscopy typically as the reference standard. This is that large Akron study I talked about from the American College of Radiology Imaging Network that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine back in 2008. It included 15 sites. We were one of them. It included both academic and private practice sites. Used state-of-the-art multi-detector CT scanners. The tagging, as I mentioned, and then use of both 2D and 3D images for review. And look at the results are excellent. And you can see that this is based on polyp size. And so remember when I talked about that at the 10 millimeter mark, that really is the large size category where there's increasing concern for harboring malignancy. Well, the per-patient sensitivity of virtual colonoscopy in this study was at 90%. You can see that at the 9-millimeter mark, it was at 90%. As you decrease in size, there is decreasing sensitivity. So at the 6-millimeter and larger mark, it's at closer to 80%. And this holds true for colonoscopy as well, in that as the polyp size decreases, it's just harder to find them. Okay, and that's pretty intuitive. But certainly does very well for the larger size polyps that you should be concerned about. And you can see that the per-patient specificity was good also in the high 80s. Also, this was another study published in the New England Journal of Medicine comparing two different arms, looking at the detection of what's called advanced neoplasia, again, precursors to colorectal cancer, and this was published in New England Journal of Medicine. So when you look at the arms, about 3,000 patients in each arm, the total number of cases of advanced neoplasia identified was about the same, 123 here, 121 here. But the number of polypectomies that were performed to identify these number of cases was significantly lower using the virtual colonoscopy compared to the number that needed to be performed for the colonoscopy. In addition, there were 7 perforations in the colonoscopy arm and 0 in the virtual colonoscopy arm. It just shows that virtual colonoscopy is as effective. Now, this is not just a test being used developed in the United States. This has gone global internationally. And you can see that there are multiple countries that have performed significant research in the area and currently using virtual colonoscopy for both screening and for diagnosis. This is out of Germany, published back in 2009 in the journal Gut. A smaller number of screening-type patients, about 300. These are asymptomatic, average-risk, what we would call our screening-type patients. And you can see that the bipolyp sensitivity for the 9 millimeters and larger as well as the 6 millimeter and larger was quite high, over 90%. You can see 94% here, 91% here. Same thing for the bipatient sensitivity, over 90%, and even specificity was very high. This was out of Italy, called the IMPACT study, published in JAMA in 2009. Larger number, close to 1,000 symptomatic patients. And when you look at the results by size category, it's remarkable how similar it is to the Akron study results that I showed you. Again, just showing you that, you know, what we have published in the United States has really been echoed, I think, globally. And then just to show you multiple publications, this top one is out of Canada. It's beginning to seem rather irresponsible to continue to offer the routine double contrast barium enema examinations. More than 90 Canadian radiology departments have purchased the necessary carbon dioxide insufflators. This is out of Israel, published in 2008, so already several years ago. You can see that over 15,000 virtual colonoscopy exams were performed, most of them on state-of-the-art CT using low-dose protocols. This is out of Sweden. CTC currently performed in 42% of radiology departments. Of those not performing the virtual colonoscopy, 38% intended to start shortly. This is out of Korea. Their guidelines, virtual colonoscopy is a valid option for colorectal cancer screening. And then this is out of Hong Kong, where they had their first ever virtual colonoscopy training workshop in 2014. Why? Is because colorectal cancer is the number one cancer in both men and women in Hong Kong. In spite of all of this, you might have heard, is Medicare back in 2008 decided that they did not want to reimburse nationally for screening CTC for the age 65-year-old and above individuals, and there were 3 areas of concern. They wanted more information on radiation dose, the cost effectiveness of evaluating all of these extracolonic findings, and then very interestingly, for the first time, they never asked this of any of the other colorectal cancer screening tools, is what's the actual performance, the sensitivity, the specificity in age 65-year-old and above adults right? And so I think they just set the bar differently for virtual colonoscopy compared to any of the other screening tools. I can tell you that all of these issues were addressed pretty promptly, and multiple studies since 2008 and 2009 have been published in each of these areas. We talked about radiation dose already. I don't think that it's, as I showed you, is not a concern at this point. And the latest version of the, we'll talk a little bit more about the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force draft recommendation statement, I think really is not as concerned about radiation dose, particularly because CT scanners, the most current CT scanners, have options for significantly lowering dose. What about the extracolonic findings, though? Let's talk a little bit about that. And you can see that there have been multiple studies performed looking at the incidence of extracolonic findings and then the additional cost for evaluating these. And when you look at the percentage of patients with extracolonic findings amongst all of these studies, you can see that it's very common. You know, so in patients who undergo the CT scan, we'll find a lot of, kidney cysts or liver cysts, but benign lesions that actually don't require any additional follow-up. When you look at the percentage of patients with actually what we call significant extracolonic findings, and what we mean by significant is a finding that would then stimulate an additional imaging test or an additional test, whether it be a laboratory test. And when you look at these numbers, they're much lower in the 5 to 10% range, okay, looking at the larger studies and really looking at an average. You do have your outliers, and you can see in the Akron study, the 16% was quite high, but they did not take into account extracolonic findings that had already been present on a prior imaging test. And I think that that added to why that those numbers were higher. When you look at the additional cost per CTC exam or per virtual colonoscopy exam, you can see that the numbers are quite consistent in the range of less than $35 and quite reasonable. And just to show you what we can pick up outside of the colon on these virtual colonoscopy exams, none of you are radiologists, I assume. This is an axial, so cutting transversely across the abdomen. This is a coronal, so cutting yourself this way is a coronal. But these are enlarged and calcified adrenal glands that you see here also on the coronal view. And this is due to granulomatous disease, and typically in the Midwest it's histoplasmosis, or it can be due to tuberculosis. Completely benign. Okay, but identified on the CTC or the virtual colonoscopy. What about here? Patient comes in and we find this fatty lesion of the right adrenal gland, completely benign, called a myelolipoma. You do nothing about this. Okay, so these would fall into that, 60% of patients have something outside of the colon, but we're not going to do anything about it. However, this is something different. When this patient comes in and you can see has gallstones, this is the gallbladder, this is the liver, right kidney, and what do we see in the left kidney? Is this large soft tissue mass. And you know what? This turned out to be a renal cell carcinoma, a kidney cancer, okay? What about this case? And I read this one myself. And here you have a non-contour deforming kidney cancer. So this is picked up. We give IV contrast, and you can see it right there. You know what? I remember this case vividly because we went back and we talked to the patient's primary care doctor. And they said, it's very unusual because the patient does not have any flank pain, doesn't have any pain there, doesn't have any hematuria, which is blood in the urine, which is typical finding if you have a kidney cancer. So we caught this renal cell carcinoma at an earlier stage. The patient underwent partial nephrectomy and is doing well. Okay. So, when the patient comes in and the colon may be completely negative, but we may be able to find something else that's causing the symptoms. This was a study published in the Archives of Internal Medicine in 2008, and it looked at virtual colonoscopy to screen not only for colorectal cancers, but as I mentioned, for cancers outside the colon, and then for abdominal aortic aneurysm. Now, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommends that males who have ever smoked between the age of 65 and 75 should undergo screening for abdominal aortic aneurysm with ultrasound. Well, we propose that when you perform a virtual colonoscopy, you can actually use it to screen for that abdominal aortic aneurysm. We see the abdominal aorta in great detail. So it's a great test to actually evaluate for AAAs, what we call AAAs. And let me just show you. So in this particular patient, this is an example of a huge abdominal aortic aneurysm that was actually extending into bilateral common iliac arteries. This was a patient who, where the colon was completely normal, and this turned out to be a lymphoma of the stomach. So the patient didn't need a colonoscopy. They actually needed an upper endoscopy. So in this study, they found that the virtual colonoscopy or CT colonography is a dominant screening strategy, more clinically effective and more cost-effective over both colonoscopy and colonoscopy with one-time ultrasound. Okay. The question from Medicare about performance of CTC or virtual colonoscopy in an older patient cohort over the age of 65. You can see four studies were published in quick succession after that 2008-2009 decision. And what the big, you know, lots of numbers here, I know. But the take-home here is the what's in red, which is not statistically significant. So when you compare the findings between the senior cohort, age 65 and above, to the non-senior cohort, when you compare statistically, there was absolutely no difference. And so virtual colonoscopy is picking up precursor lesion just as well. And just to note that President Obama, as I mentioned, for African Americans, should undergo colorectal cancer screening at an earlier age, 45. When he had his first colon cancer screening test, what do you think he chose? It was a virtual colonoscopy, right? So he did not have the colonoscopy, he picked the CT colonography, right? Just to let you know, I think this is a sort of something that is not well known, is that your insurance company may already cover the screening virtual colonoscopy. Here's not a complete list, but some of the major national private payers already will reimburse not only for the diagnostic virtual colonoscopy, but for screening as well. And the big ones are Cigna, United Healthcare, Unicare, and then the Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield. And you can see the various Blue Cross Blue Shield in the various states. I pulled this off the Cigna webpage. Their coverage policy, for an average risk individuals age 50 years and older, Cigna covers as medically necessary the following colorectal cancer screening tests. And you can see that they include the CT colonography or virtual colonoscopy every 5 years. So they follow the American Cancer Society guidelines. This is off the United Healthcare website. CT colonography is proven for the following. They include as a screening test for colon cancer. This is off the Unicare website. Medically necessary, okay, for screening of average risk individuals. And they include CT colonography or the virtual colonoscopy. So if you have any of these large payers as your insurance company, they do cover it, and you can request it, okay, to be covered. Of note, in 2013, the FDA convened a specific joint meeting of a panel to address the safety and the efficacy of virtual colonoscopy, or CTC. And I want you to read this executive summary. All members of the joint panels agreed that given the risks and benefits identified, CT colonoscopy should be one option for colorectal cancer screening of asymptomatic patients. So they find that CTC is a valid option. In spite of all of this, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force has proposed their draft recommendation This is their process, and we are in the step four of they are finalizing their recommendation statement. This was released in October, and in their recommendation statement, they gave colorectal cancer screening an A rating. And what the A means is that they recommend screening for colorectal cancer starting at age 50 and continuing until age 75. The risks and benefits of different screening methods vary. They gave colorectal cancer screening for the older elderly, so age 76 and above, a C rating, meaning that it's not recommended for all patients in that age category, and that the decision should be left to the patient and the healthcare provider, looking at the particular patient's comorbid conditions, and not necessary to perform as a routine screening. And that can be a bit controversial as well. You know, clearly there was confusion, right? Because then they released this and they called it understanding the task force draft recommendations, trying to help us to figure out what exactly they were saying. And so where does virtual colonoscopy fall is down here in that they say evidence clearly shows that several different types of screening tests reduce deaths from colorectal cancer, and they include the different stool tests. And so this is the fecal occult blood test and the fecal immunochemical test, the flexible sigmoidoscopy combined with the stool testing, and then colonoscopy. They put down as alternative tests with less evidence may also be useful in select circumstances, including the virtual colonoscopy. And then they included the stool DNA testing also in this category, which is interesting because the stool DNA testing is already reimbursed by Medicare or CMS. So why do I emphasize this and talk about this is because the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force is a federal body, and they do work with and I think in conjunction with Medicare. And so Medicare does pay attention to, I think, the USPSTF recommendations. Our hope is that, and through, you know, multiple organizations, and I think that, you know, there's strong evidence as a rebuttal to a very detailed draft recommendation statement that was submitted back to the USPSTF. This is dynamic. This is happening now. Is to reclassify virtual colonoscopy into the recommended test. There certainly is enough peer-reviewed published evidence to support that. So this is still to be decided, and we're just sort of waiting for the USPSTF to review the submitted documents. I did want to bring to your attention that there are resources out there for you as the public and as potential patients. If you're interested in obtaining a virtual colonoscopy or a CT colonography, you're certainly welcome to, if you have specific questions, you can email me or look at the web resources. And this is from the American College of Radiology. I work closely with them and have developed a lot of this. This is the website for this. When you enter this portal, you'll see that there is the private payer coverage, so you can check to see if your insurance company is in there. There are informational brochures that are geared for patients that can answer some of the questions that you might have. This is actually a particular brochure that we worked on that and have made available to radiologists and radiology offices to make available to patients. And it really just tells you exactly what the test is, what the risks are, and where you can go for additional information. I also wanted to bring to your attention the American College of Radiology appropriateness criteria. And this is a rating scheme of what the American College of Radiology feels is the most appropriate test for a particular disease entity for diagnosis. And for colorectal cancer screening, a higher number is best. You can see that 9 is really the highest that you can get as the most appropriate. And you can see the virtual colonoscopy, or CTC, is rated highest at a 9. The older test, the double contrast barium enema, has fallen in its rating, and it's currently at a 6. Okay. Another site that you might want to check out is the radiologyinfo.org. And this is through the largest radiology organization in the country, the RSNA, or the Radiology Society of North America. And again, there's great information on here that is updated pretty frequently, and please do visit this website as well. So, in closing, here are my summary points, and I hope that I've shown you that the virtual colonoscopy is validated as an effective and a safe screening test, that you should not be concerned about the radiation dose. We really have gotten it down to very low dose, equivalent to or less than the annual background dose, and there are studies that to support that the benefits of getting screened with a virtual colonoscopy really outweighs any risk. CTC, or virtual colonoscopy, is supported as a screening tool already by the American Cancer Society and the FDA, and as I showed you, by the major private payers. And so if you are asymptomatic, average risk, no family history, no personal history that will put you at risk, so completely a screening-type patient, but you have not had your colorectal cancer screening, this is a preventable malignancy, so you should consider virtual colonoscopy. I leave you with this, which is that an American dies of colon cancer every 9 minutes, and this is a tragedy because this can be completely prevented. Also, so I started off with why you should care. This is you should care, and that, as I mentioned, you will need to get screened at some point. Someone you know has colorectal cancer. Someone you know will develop colorectal cancer. Someone you know will unfortunately die from colorectal cancer unnecessarily. And this malignancy is preventable if you come in and you get screened. So thank you so much. Happy to take questions. Yes. The question is, what is the reasoning behind not recommending colorectal cancer screening starting at the age of 76? So what I called is the older elderly. And, you know, I would love for one of the panel members from the USPSTF to defend that. I certainly am not defending that, but I think that the reasoning behind that is that given the lag time between when a polyp is identified to when it transitions into a malignancy, they feel that, you know, as you go from 76 to older, that life expectancy obviously is lower. And so the chances of developing the invasive cancer, you know, before actually dying is probably, you know, about the same or not worth it.
So it's not related to any side effects or dangers?
No. No, not as far as I know. Other questions? Yes. Right. So if you have what's called a failed colonoscopy because the gastroenterologist can't get the scope all the way to the cecum, right, you can be referred for virtual colonoscopy. And depending upon your insurance, that should be covered, right?
But I'm on Medicare, so.
Medicare doesn't reimburse for that, unfortunately. That's what we're fighting for. You know, I need you to join the fight for that. But in terms of what the cost is out of pocket, there's a range. And I can tell you that the cost is probably about $1,000. Okay. In terms of if you find a polyp, if it is of a certain size, then yes, then you do need to come in and have it taken out. Now, there are different options if, you know, when they do a colonoscopy, they use a traditional scope. And if you have a colon that's particularly redundant or tough, and it seems like you do, to get to the right colon to complete it, they can try different strategies with a, you know, perhaps a pediatric scope or a smaller scope or a different scope to try to get in there to take it out. The fact of the matter is that most patients will not have anything, right? And so for those patients who have a failed colonoscopy, virtual colonoscopy should be covered. And even for Medicare, you might want to check to see if they will cover it because you have had a failed colonoscopy and attempt already, because they may cover it, actually. Okay? Yes. Okay, that's a good question. So it depends on what the virtual colonoscopy is being performed on, whether it's a symptomatic patient or a screening. So for screening patients, the percentage of patients who will have a 10 millimeter or larger polyp is about 10 to 12%. Okay, we'll need to go on for a colonoscopy and have that taken out. If you have a 6 to 9 millimeter polyp, you may or may not elect to have that taken out because, as I mentioned, that's considered a small size polyp. Gastroenterologists will encourage you to have that taken out if they're in there anyways. But if you do a virtual colonoscopy, your options are to follow it. If you only
don't need it until the next CTC.
Correct.
You
correct.
Don't need the biopsy until the next CTC.
Correct.
Colonoscopy.
Yes. The question was, does a gastroenterologist get involved if it's for the virtual colonoscopy? You know, it's interesting. We have a very collaborative relationship with our gastroenterologists, where I'm based out at the VA, actually. And they have been included in my research studies, and, you know, they know what virtual colonoscopies look like. We show them the interesting cases. If we have a question, you know, I pick up the phone and I call them. Or if they have a particularly difficult patient, they'll pick up the phone and they'll call me. But they do not read the virtual colonoscopy, the radiologists do. I think the key here is to remember that this is not just the fancy fly-throughs that I showed you. You really need to be able to have the training in the eye to coordinate what you're seeing and correlate what you're seeing on the 3D views with what you see on the 2D views. And gastroenterologists are not trained to read the 2D images. They certainly cannot evaluate for the extracolonic findings, right? So it is a radiologist study. There are some sites, though, where, you know, gastroenterologists attempt to do the virtual colonoscopy. So some go back for additional training and can do virtual colonoscopy quite well. But that's the minority by far. Yes. Yeah. You know, that's a great question. And the obviously not everyone will come in for the screening no matter what. And I don't know of anybody who has done that kind of an analysis. There is a cost-effectiveness analysis that was just published in the November issue of Abdominal Imaging. The Milliman study by Pyenson was the first author on that I could refer you to, that looks at different scenarios of virtual colonoscopy because, you know, there's so many different ways that you can analyze the virtual colonoscopy. And depending upon how you analyze it, you know, whether you include the follow-up of the extracolonic findings or not, whether you look at the benefit from having prevented X number of cancers, right? And so the different studies have looked at it in different ways. What was great about this particular study was they not only did the main analysis, but they also gave like 9 different scenarios. And in every single scenario, virtual colonoscopy was found to be cost-effective, every single one. So that's the latest that I know of, and that's a great paper that we actually sent in to the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. It was just published, hot off the press. Yes. Again, I'm not going to repeat that whole question because it's a very long question. But I think that was the David Kim study that you were talking about. And what they did was so basically what they showed was that it took many more colonoscopies to diagnose the same number of cases of advanced neoplasia, right? So gastroenterologists, when they're doing the colonoscopy, whenever they see a polyp, they're going to take it out, right? By far, the majority are not going to be premalignant or malignant, right? So they do many, many more of them to identify the same number of cases of advanced neoplasia. I think that for the CTC, what they're looking for is based on size and morphology, right? And that is those are the characteristics that we use to help guide us to, and the number of lesions, as to whether we think something is malignant or not, or premalignant.
Would that necessarily indicate then that a follow-up in 5 years would do a comparison of polyps found by a CT colonoscopy to determine whether something identified as a polyp but not taken out at that time?
Yeah.
It might become more enlarged or something.
That's a good question, and they have done a lot of the follow-up work at the University of Wisconsin, where they have done many, many virtual colonoscopies, and they have that kind of long-term follow-up. And what they have found is they miss extremely few number of polyps that become malignant, and have shown that CTC is very, very good at identifying those premalignant polyps. Yes. Yeah, that's what they call cancer screening, in that it identifies the cancer, but doesn't prevent the cancer, right? And that's the key. You know, when you look at the costs, what's the least costly of all of the colorectal cancer screening tools is the FOBT, right, and the FIT. And I think that, you know, that certainly is a huge factor as to why that's the default screening tool for colorectal cancer. I think it takes an educated public, and you know, those on the front line. So it's the primary care, internal medicine, physicians, and that's the effort of the American College of Radiology, I can tell you, is this outreach and education, and to I think really collaborate with the gastroenterologists, which we're trying to do, and to show them that this is not threatening, but it's a complementary tool, and we're not taking away, you know, business. In fact, you know, we would, the way that I always think about it, and I think this is the correct way to think about it, is that our goal is to bring many more patients in to get screened. We'll take care of those that are negative, and the cases that we send on to colonoscopy, those are much more likely to have a significant polyp that needs polypectomy. So gastroenterologists, they should really, and there aren't that, you know, as many of them, they should focus their efforts really on performing the diagnostic colonoscopies, where they are much more likely to find a polyp that they need to take out. Yes. So it does take an educated public, and I can tell you that there is, in the past, we've had congressional support. Bills have been introduced in the past multiple years, consecutive years, into both the House and the Senate. This is, you know, with the USPSTF really just releasing their draft recommendation statement, there's been a backlash, and I think a lot of the medical community is frankly surprised and curious as to why virtual colonoscopy is not reimbursed at this point. There's so much more evidence for virtual colonoscopy at this point, and so we are looking at, we would expect that there will be bills dropped in both the House and the Senate upcoming. I would encourage you to write to your local congressmen and women to get them on board. But this is more of a grassroots effort.
There's not any, you know, like, say, online petition that you will
know. There will be. Look for it in within the next couple of weeks. Just Google it. It'll come up. I'm serious. Just Google it. Yes. No, that's not, it was not, the cost of the test was not $35. If you take the total cost used to, in that patient cohort, that particular study, and you divide it by the number of patients that were included in the study, so it's the average cost of the workup.
So
There's no test that's going to cost $30. Okay, I can tell you that. Yes. Take a look at this. So this was published in the New York Times in June of 2013, and it was entitled The $2.7 Trillion Medical Bill, Colonoscopies Explain Why the U.S. Leads the World in Health Expenditures. So they look at the average U.S. price, and they put it at $1,185. I guess we should all go to Switzerland, where it's much cheaper, and we need to get our Lipitor in New Zealand and your angiogram in Canada. $35. Oh, you can get something for $30. But when you dig deeper, and this is from that same paper, you can see that the costs are actually much more. Look at the cost in New York. $8,577. This is the cost of a colonoscopy, okay? In California, San Francisco, $4,849. L.A., more expensive, $5,559. The billed. Your insurance covers it, though, right? And Medicare will cover it.
But they don't pay that.
No, they negotiate a rate, right? But this is what, you know, will be billed. Okay.
So when you gave you can't compare the billed price to the out-of-pocket price.
Correct. Correct.
So when you gave the $1,000 out-of-pocket, is that the bill?
It's not reimbursed. If it's not reimbursed, that is out-of-pocket. Exactly.
So that's and if you didn't have insurance, that's what you'd have to pay.
Correct. Correct.
Are you including the radiologist time, the hospital time, the scanner time, and that $1,000 that seems awfully low?
Well, it used to be much higher, but I think the competitive market has brought it back down. So.
But so much of that analysis is done algorithmically, right? Do the scanner, the computer does a lot of it.
Well, that's a good question about how much. When you look at how tests are valued, it's by, you know, not only the technical fee, so it's the cost of using the machine, right, and the overhead for the use of the machine, and it's the cost of the radiologist. Radiologist time is very cheap. I can tell you that. The time and intensity of a CT colonography is fairly high, meaning that it's a learning curve for radiologists. Some radiologists have resistance to reading these. You know, I love reading them. It's my favorite exam to do and read. But, some radiologists would prefer to read, you know, other things that take less time, you know, is not as intense. So it takes special training in the American College of Radiology to come up with specific guidelines as to what qualifies you in order to be able to read these as a radiologist. You have to be specifically trained to do this and have special qualification. Okay? For polyps. Absolutely. So is there computer-aided detection, basically, which is called CAD? Now, you might have heard about CAD, computer-aided detection, for mammography, for example, right, or for lung cancer screening on the CT scan. And yes, already out there, and we use it already, is computer-aided detection for polyps. And I can tell you that it works really well. For somebody who is very experienced, and you know, for me, it doesn't really do a whole lot because I can pick up the polyps. But I think for novice readers, in particular for the smaller lesions, can pick them up and add confidence as well. So, yes, it's a commercially available product. Yes. There are never enough radiologists. I think that as we move forward and as life expectancy actually increases with baby boomers, more and more seniors will need health care. And the answer is not going to be surgery, you know, without imaging. Or, a lot of times for less invasive detection, less invasive treatment. And it's not just detection of disease. It's also for treatment of disease that imaging is being brought in more and more. Radiology is just exploding in terms of the different. I mean, we use CT, MR, ultrasound, fluoroscopy, And that's actually what's kept me in radiology is, you know, we always say every 7 years there is, you know, a major event that happens in one of the imaging modalities so that it revolutionizes how you view the same pathology. And it makes it easier for us to identify disease earlier and differently. So functional exams, for example, with molecular imaging is huge. Looking at personalized medicine and using imaging and incorporating it into that. So it really is a wonderful field to be in. We don't have enough radiologists. I think that we have to go back and take a look at increasing, I think, residencies, being allowed to do that. Again, it's really to treat, I think, a larger senior population. So good point. Okay, I'm going to have to end. So thank you so much for coming.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.